welcome to this reading of the Mason City Globe-Gazette. This is the Wednesday, September 28th edition. It's brought to you here on the morning of Thursday, September the 29th. Hope you're having a great start to your day. This is Andrew Haupt here on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Starting off first, though, before we get to the headline stories, with the weather here on this reading of the Mason City Globe-Gazette. And for today, you can expect sunshine and breezy conditions, those winds out of the south, up to 16 miles per hour. Very mild, temperate high of 68 degrees for your Thursday. For tonight, expect a low down at 42 degrees. For tomorrow, partly sunny and breezy conditions, with winds from the south and southeast, gustier, up to 20 miles per hour. A warmer high of 72 degrees for your Friday. Very nice indeed. Just perfect, actually. For Friday night, low 44. For Saturday, high 73. For Sunday, warmer yet, a high 75 degrees. As we are taking a look at the headlines here of the Mason City Globe-Gazette, on page A1, 43 North Iowa receives grant. The Mason City-based nonprofit gets $2.7 million from state fund. Also, U.S. judge strikes down Iowa's third ag-gag law. Law aimed to stop animal welfare groups from secretly filming. Interesting stuff. Teaching for the Real World is another headline here, and it shows Jackson, a boss, in the headline photo, standing there in his tool shop, is teaching his first year of Project Lead the Way at Clear Lake Middle School. And then finally, McConnell backs election law fix, bipartisan legislation, a response to efforts for the 2020 election, says, to overturn the 2020 vote. We'll learn about that from the AP, all that and more here on the Mason City Globe-Gazette, including a check of sports after we have a quick check of obituaries at the bottom of the hour. But starting it off now, 43 North Iowa receives grant. This Mason City-based nonprofit gets $2.7 million from state fund, written by Mary Loden of the Globe-Gazette. Well, story goes on to start. 43 North Iowa, a Mason City-based organization that helps North Central Iowans with mental health or other disabilities, was recently notified of a $2.7 million grant award from the Iowa Nonprofit Innovation Fund. Governor Kim Reynolds announced that $40 million in grant funding has been directed to 24 organizations for infrastructure projects that will enable Iowa nonprofits. Funding for this grant opportunity was made available through the Federal American Rescue Plan Act. Eligible expenses for infrastructure projects include construction cost, acquisition, site development, engineering, and architectural services. 43 North Iowa is excited to receive the innovation grant funding to expand our residential care facility capacity and bring crisis stabilization services to the area, said John Derryberry, 43, or it could be 43, North Iowa Executive Director, in a press release. This is a big first step to the completion of that goal, but we are not across the finish line yet. Derryberry said they are working through the steps of purchasing a building, but are doing their due diligence. He said they need to make sure their plans meet Iowa's building code, that it will fit their needs and be a safe place for both clients and staff. Before I go on to the continued story on page A2, I will tell you that the photo shows, one shows a picture, a mugshot of Derryberry, but also shows a picture of their facilities, their offices, located on 2nd Street Northeast in Mason City. We want to thank the area agencies that supported our grant application. Their valuable information on the need for expanded access to mental health services in North Iowa showed how worthy our application was, Derryberry said in the release. Finding solutions to make our community safer and more inclusive for our most vulnerable neighbors is a win for all North Iowa. All right, that ends that story. Moving on now to Teaching for the Real World. Clear Lake's A Boss guides students with hands-on learning. That's written by Abby Koch of the Globe-Gazette. A class in Clear Lake is answering the question, age-old student question, when will we use this in real life? Project Lead the Way, or PLTW, is a STEM-based curriculum. It is giving Clear Lake Middle School students an opportunity in hands-on learning and being more creative. It's just another way for kids to connect with education curriculum because it brings in very hands-on stuff, said Principal Mike Lester. I would say that's the biggest thing is that creative mindset. It's not simply just doing something and moving on. They have to use that creative functioning mindset. Well, the middle school program has an engineering track to it. According to PLTW teacher Jackson Abbas, a new addition to the district. He teaches the national curriculum to the 8th grade students all year, while 6th and 7th grade students still receive similar components in different classes like robotics. Each quarter is something different. We started out with green architecture. We've been working with a computer program building 3D models, said Abbas. In a real-life lesson, Abbas, who has a math background, had his students work on figuring out flooring within a house and having a certain budget. Lester says he had multiple students show off their flooring plans to him and discuss their dream layout, then reflect on if they could see themselves doing it as a career. When kids find you and tell you that, that's pretty powerful, said Lester. Abbas instructs his students on skill they can use anywhere, such as using a tape measure. He added it answers their questions of, when will I use this? I would say the biggest thing with this curriculum, it does a really good job of taking the skills that you learned and applying them right away, Abbas said. Abbas hopes to bring in guest speakers who can bring in a community aspect to the class while showing real people who use the same skills to the students are learning. PLTW hits Clear Lake's goal of literacy across the board, working in multiple subject areas as a collaborative effort. Abbas works alongside math and science teachers to ensure kids have understanding of lessons and skills. Although it is too early to know, Lester believes the class will help the students testing scores. It's going to be tough to know since it is our first year doing it, so we could see an increase within the next 3 years possibly, Lester said. Abbas' goal with his group is to start developing the skills for when they step into the workforce. I just want them to learn how to be problem solvers and independent thinkers, said Abbas. There will be times when I give them a prompt and then the questions kind of come up naturally. I don't always want to give them an answer right away. I just say, how can we figure this out? Well, Lester said the group has a good teacher at the helm, helping kids connect with the curriculum. A program is as good as a person in it, and I think Mr. Abbas is going to be a great person for that, said Lester. Again, that written by Abby Koch. And from there we go to U.S. judge strikes down Iowa's third ag-gag law, so-called ag-gag law, aimed to stop animal welfare groups from secretly filming. That's written by David Pitt of the AP, Dateline Des Moines, where a federal judge has struck down the third attempt by the Iowa legislature to stop animal welfare groups from secretly filming livestock abuse, finding once again that the law passed last year violates free speech rights in the U.S. Constitution. The decision Monday rejected the law approved by Iowa lawmakers in April of 2021 that makes it a crime to trespass on a property to place a camera to record or transmit images. The law, which has support from Republicans and some Democrats, made the first offense punishable by up to 2 years in prison and subsequent offenses a felony. The case is one of many so-called ag-gag laws that have surfaced in the U.S. in recent years that the right of farmers to protect their property from trespassers against animal welfare advocates. Farmers argue intruders could track in disease and want to unfairly portray their livestock practices, while animal welfare groups say producers don't want the public to see how farm animals are treated. The lawsuit was filed in federal court on August 10, 2021, by animal rights groups, the Animal Legal Defense Fund, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, that would be PETA, and Bailing Out Benji. They were joined by environmental and grassroots advocacy groups, Food and Water Watch, and Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement. It was the ninth lawsuit challenging ag-gag state laws around the country. In addition to the challenges to the three Iowa laws, earlier lawsuits have resulted in courts striking down similar laws in North Carolina, Kansas, Idaho, Utah, and Wyoming. A challenge to the Arkansas law is currently pending in the district court. An appeal of a district court decision striking down North Carolina's law is pending in the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, and an appeal of Iowa's second law is pending in the 8th U.S. Circuit. Iowa lawmakers have been trying to pass such laws since 2012. Significant portions have been struck down by courts, while a few provisions that enhance the penalties for trespassing in farms and meat production facilities have survived. Lawyers for the state of Iowa argued that because the 2021 law applies to speech on private property, the First Amendment's protections are significantly diminished. They said the interests of the farmer override any free speech concerns of the animal rights groups involved in criminal trespass. Judge Stephanie Rose rejected that argument, saying other courts have noted that exempting private property from any First Amendment review could result in the criminalization of core free speech, such as criticism of a politician. She also said the U.S. Supreme Court has previously invalidated laws that regulate free speech on private property. She rejected the state's motion to dismiss the lawsuit and granted the animal rights group's motion to find the law unconstitutional and block its enforcement. She gave attorneys for both sides 30 days to draft language for a permanent injunction that would prevent the state from enforcing the law. The advocacy group said the decision is important to farm and food processing plant workers placed in unsafe working conditions who are now protected under free speech rights to record evidence for advocates fighting to expose poor living conditions and treatment of dogs at breeding farms known as puppy mills and for animals raised for food. The ability to investigate and document how our food is made is critical in ensuring a just and transparent food system that holds companies and government institutions accountable, says David Maraskin, the Food Project Litigation Director for Public Justice, a Washington-based nonprofit law firm that represented grassroots advocacy group Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement in the lawsuit. In a heavily agricultural state like Iowa, where farmers raise millions of pigs each year for meat and chickens for eggs, protecting a huge segment of the state's economy from negative publicity is a priority. Farmers and sympathetic lawmakers say laws are needed to enforce the basic right for livestock producers to control who enters their property and barns. They say livestock farmers aren't hiding anything but don't trust the activists to accurately portray how animals are treated. The state may appeal Rose's decision to the 8th U.S. Circuit. A spokesman for the Iowa Attorney General's office, which represented the state, said they are still reviewing the decision. A spokesman for the Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds did not immediately respond to a message seeking a comment. And the photo here on this page shows Sabri Zill is her name, who's putting on a blindfold as Melissa Elwanger holds a large sign with members of Mercy for Animals. And it says, the sign says ag-gag, bad for consumers. And the Mercy for Animals is a national animal advocacy group, and they are protesting the passage of an ag gag law at the Iowa Capitol in Des Moines that took place March 1st, 2012, all the way back then. That photo by Justin Hayworth of the Register. And then the final front page story here, McConnell backs election law fix. Bipartisan legislation, a response to efforts to overturn the 2020 vote, written by Mary Claire Jelonic of the Associated Press, Dateline Washington. Before I go any further, I'll tell you what the photo is, showing it looked like a very zonked out Mitch McConnell. Whatever his expression he's got on his face, it looks like one of surprise, but I can't tell. But he's in the photo here by J. Scott Applewhite, an AP photo, along with Senator Richard Shelby of Alabama on Tuesday as they attend a Senate Rules and Administration Committee meeting at the Capitol in Washington. So this is how the story goes. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell said Tuesday he will proudly support legislation, this is on Tuesday, to overhaul rules for certifying presidential elections, bolstering a bipartisan effort to revise a 19th century law and avoid another January 6th insurrection. The legislation would clarify and expand parts of the 1887 Electoral Count Act, which, along with the Constitution, governs how many states and Congress certify electors and declare presidential winners. The changes in the certification process are in response to unsuccessful efforts by former President Donald Trump and his allies to exploit loopholes in the law to overturn his 2020 defeat to Joe Biden and violent attack on the Capitol by his supporters as Congress counted the votes. So-called. Congress process for counting the presidential electors' votes was written 135 years ago, McConnell said. The chaos that came to a head on January 6th of last year certainly underscored the need for an update. McConnell made the remarks just before the Senate Rules Committee voted 14-1 to approve the bill and send it to the Senate floor, where a vote is expected after the November election. The only senator to vote against the legislation was Republican Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, one of two senators to object to Biden's certification last year. The GOP leader's endorsement gave the legislation a major boost as the bipartisan group pushes to pass the bill before the end of the year and ahead of the next election cycle. Trump is still pushing claims of election fraud and saying he won the election as he considers another run in 2024. McConnell's support for the law could put him even more at odds with Trump, who frequently berates the GOP leader and encouraged Republicans to vote against it. The House already passed a more expansive bill overhauling the election rules, or electoral rules rather, but it has far less Republican support. While the House bill received a handful of GOP votes, the Senate version already has the backing of at least 12 Republicans, more than enough to break a filibuster and pass the legislation in the 50-50 Senate. As he announced his support, McConnell noted that Democrats also objected to legitimate election results the last three times that Republicans won the presidency. The situation obviously called for careful, methodical, and bipartisan work, he said, noting that the bipartisan group that negotiated the bill worked on the language for months. McConnell called the House bill a non-starter in the Senate because of the bipartisan compromise on the Senate language. "We have one shot to get this right," he said. Senator Amy Klobuchar, the Democratic chairwoman of the Senate Rules Panel, expressed a similar sentiment. "The Senate legislation is the bill that will achieve a strong bipartisan consensus," she said. Cruz was the only dissenter among the Republicans on the Rules Panel who voted for the bill shortly after McConnell's statement, were Mississippi Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith, one of only eight senators to vote against Biden's certification, and Tennessee Senator Bill Hagerty, a strong Trump ally. And that does it for all of the front page news here. It looks like page A2 is mostly just follow-on stories from page A1. So moving on now to page A3. Early harvest reports better than expected. The photo at the top shows a farmer harvesting corn on the south side of Waterloo. That photo from last year, September 14th, 2021. It's written by Jared Strong of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. "Well, it might be weeks before agriculture experts can say with confidence how the state's corn and soybean yields fared this year. But some of the early harvesters are relieved their yields are better than expected. The first fields that get harvested are hardly a barometer for what things are going to look like for the rest of the harvest, but people have been so far somewhat pleasantly surprised." That says Megan Anderson, an Iowa State University Extension field agronomist who monitors central Iowa. "But I think the bar for expectations was not super high," she said. "Planting in much of the state was delayed this year by April rains. Then the rain stopped and drought conditions spread across the northwest and southern half of the state. May, June, July, and August were all warmer and drier than normal, according to state climatologist weather summaries." Anderson said her recent survey of early corn harvest in Polk County showed an average of about 191 bushels per acre. That's about 13% lower than last year, when Iowa farmers set a new yield record. "It's significantly lower than last year, but would be considered on par with average," Anderson said. "About 5% of the state's corn crop has been harvested, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture report Monday. The harvest so far is 5 days behind last year, but just 1 day slower than the five-year average. People are really just getting started this week. We have a lot of green corn up here," said Angie Reek Hines, an ISU Extension field agronomist for North Central Iowa. "People are concerned about maturity. We're not going to be very warm this week. If we can get a little bit of heat next week, we can finish off some of the corn." Well, about 44% of the area's corn is mature. Of that area's corn is mature, the USDA report said. That compares with a high of 85% in East Central Iowa. Reek Heinz said the crop's maturation isn't too far from normal, but that farmers need favorable weather to avoid the added cost of drying too moist kernels. About 7% of the state's soybean crop has been harvested, which is 3 days behind the five-year average. Corn and soybean conditions have remained steady, with 64% of corn rated good or excellent and 62% of soybeans rated the same. Last week was unseasonably hot and averaged 6 degrees above normal, according to the USDA report. Rainfall averaged about a quarter of an inch. That is about a third of what is normally expected for that week. That is a story from the Iowa Capital Dispatch and Jared Strong, airing here on page A3 of the Mason City Globe Gazette. Other headline news from page A3, two Iowa companies sentenced in FC Mann's ethanol scheme. FC meaning Forest City. That's written by the Globe Gazette staff. Two Iowa companies were sentenced in federal court on September 21st in a multi-million dollar fraud perpetuated by a Forest City financial advisor. Enerj, spelled E-N-E-R-G-A-E, LP, and iLenders LLC received the sentences after they each pled guilty to one count of wire fraud on December 1, 2020. The company's admissions at the plea hearing, as well as the evidence presented in other court proceedings, established that Daryl Smith was a broker and advisor for several investment firms. He was also responsible corporate officer of both companies. From 2010 to 2015, Smith perpetuated a fraud scheme in which he made withdrawals of over $2.4 million in funds from 10 of his investment clients' accounts without those clients' knowledge or authorization. In some instances, the clients discovered the fraud, but in other instances, they did not learn of the theft because Smith would periodically send the clients checks from an account held in the name of the companies and on which Smith falsely represented was principal or interest on an investment. Smith used the stolen funds to pay expenses related to the operation of Permiete Refining LLC, which operated a now-defunct ethanol plant in Hopkinton. In order to transfer funds from client accounts, Smith used authorizations purportedly signed by the client authorizing the withdrawal of funds from the investment account. He either forged his client's signatures on the authorizations or used pre-signed bank authorization forms without the client's approval. The companies were sentenced by the United States District Court Chief Judge Leonard T. Strand. Each company was sentenced to 1 year of probation in order to make a $1,056,909.68 in restitution to 10 victims. That was a cost to those restitution, I should say. The court also imposed a $2,405,409.68 amount for forfeiture money judgment upon each corporation. The corporation surrendered over 57 million shares of stock in another company and abandoned certain tax credits the companies claimed to possess. The sentencing of the companies follows the sentencing of Daryl Smith and his brother David Smith in recent years. In 2018, Daryl Smith of Forest City was sentenced to more than 14 years in federal prison upon his conviction of one count of wire fraud and one count of aggravated identity theft. In 2019, David Smith of Pocatello, Idaho, was sentenced to 2 months in federal prison after pleading guilty to one count of conspiracy to obstruct, influence, and impede an official proceeding. The case was prosecuted by Assistant United States Attorney Tim Vavrichek and investigated by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the United States Postal Service Inspection Service, Internal Revenue Service Criminal Investigation, and the United States Department of Agriculture Office of Inspector General. In other news, Walmart to cover fertility treatments under insurance plan. That's written by Ann D. Anencio and Tom Murphy from the Associated Press. More news here on page A3 of the Globe Gazette. Dateline New York, where Walmart is teaming up with a fertility startup to offer benefits under its insurance plan that will help workers expand their families. The nation's largest retailer and private employer said Tuesday it's partnering with New York-based Kind Body to offer benefits such as in vitro fertilization as well as fertility testing regardless of sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, or marital status. Walmart's employees will get access to more than 30 fertility clinics and in vitro fertilization labs across the U.S. Kind Body's clinics will be available to help eligible workers across Walmart's surrogacy and adoption benefits as well. The expanded offerings which started November 1st, build on Walmart's so-called Center of Excellence model, which provides benefits and coverage for certain heart, spine, and joint surgeries and cancer treatments in partnership with healthcare providers and facilities, including the Cleveland Clinic and Mayo Clinic. Financial terms weren't disclosed. Providing access to high-quality healthcare is very important to us, and we've heard from our associates that improved access to fertility, surrogacy, and adoption support is a priority for them and their families, said Kim Lupo, Senior Vice President of Walmart Global Total Rewards. Walmart joins other major employers, including Amazon, in helping employees with adoptions or covering things like fertility treatments. More companies are adding these benefits in part to attract and retain workers in a tight labor market. But given its clout, the expanded benefits from Walmart should help further democratize fertility treatments, which can cost thousands of dollars. It signals that fertility benefits have joined medical, dental, and vision as a standard workplace benefit for leading employers, according to Gina Bartazzi, founder and chairwoman of Kind Body. The announcement of expanded fertility offerings comes after Walmart in August announced it was expanding its abortion coverage following the Supreme Court ruling that scrapped a nationwide right to abortion. Competition has grown especially tough for hourly and lower-wage workers in retail, hospitality, and healthcare sectors, according to researchers with the benefits consultant Mercer. These benefits are a way to add value without necessarily increasing pay by a significant amount, said Julie Campbell, a principal consultant in Mercer's health and benefits practice. Adding benefits that help with family planning can also make a company more attractive to LGBTQ employees. The path to parenthood can be complex and expensive, and the journey is not the same for all families, that says Lisa Woods, Walmart's vice president of benefits. Mercer's annual employer survey has tracked a big jump in companies offering help with in vitro fertilization, a core fertility benefit that involves creating embryos by mixing eggs and sperm in a lab dish. The consultant found that 36% of companies with 500 or more employees covered IVF treatments in 2021. That's up from 27% in 2020. 4 years before that, the percentage of companies offering that benefit usually hovered between 20 and 22%, said Beth Umland, Director of Health and Benefits Research at Mercer. Relatively few employees may end up using a company's help with adoption or coverage of fertility treatments, but those benefits mean a lot to the people who use them, Umland noted. Moving on now, as we've got a few minutes left before we check in with our short obituary section, group sues over debt cancellation. This from the Digest section on page A4. A libertarian group in California filed a legal challenge to Joe Biden's plan for student debt cancellation on Tuesday, calling it an illegal overreach that would increase state tax burdens for some Americans who get their debt forgiven. The lawsuit was filed by the Pacific Legal Foundation, a Sacramento legal advocacy group, in federal court in Indiana, a state that plans to tax any student debt canceled by Biden's plan. The plaintiff is Frank Garrison, an attorney who lives in Indiana, is employed by the Libertarian Group, and is on track to get his student debt erased through a separate federal program for public servants through which canceled debt cannot be taxed. Biden's plan automatically would cancel up to $20,000 of his debt, which in turn would trigger an immediate tax liability from the state of Indiana, the suit says. Student debt forgiven under Biden's plan also would be subject to taxes, state taxes in Arkansas, California, Minnesota, Mississippi, North Carolina, and Wisconsin. And this out of Des Moines, Capitol rioter gets 7-year prison term. A judge sentenced Kyle Young, age 38, to 7 years in prison Tuesday, calling him a one-man wrecking ball who helped in a sustained assault on a police officer. Judge Amy Berman Jackson sentenced Kyle Young of Redfield, Iowa, in U.S. District Court in Washington, noting he admitted to helping in the assault of a police officer during the January 6, 2021 event. She gave him credit for the 17 months he's been held, meaning he likely will serve nearly 6 years in prison. It is one of the longest sentences so far in the riot that halted the certification of Joe Biden's electoral victory and sent lawmakers running for their lives. Young cried as he apologized to former D.C. Metropolitan Police Officer Michael Ferrone and said he wished he could take back his actions on that day. "I hope someday you forgive me," he said. And one brief here. European pipelines. Explosions rattled the Baltic Sea before unusual leaks were discovered on two underwater natural gas pipelines running from Russia, seismologists said Tuesday. European leaders and experts pointed to possible sabotage amid an energy standoff with Russia over the war in Ukraine. We're just over the halfway point here of the Mason City Globe Gazette reading. This is the Wednesday, September 28th edition, as brought to you here on the morning of September 29th. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Just a reminder that all material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. This is your reader today. My name is Andrew Haupt, filling in. If you have comments on this or any other IRIS program, then please feel free to give us a call here at the office, 515-243-6833 in Central Iowa, or toll-free across the state, 1-877-404-4747. And now, we don't really have any full obituaries here in the paper, but we do have death notices, Globe death notices, and we have three listed for today. The first, for Susan J. Fisher, age 77, of Clarion, died Sunday, September 25th at Clarion Wellness and Rehabilitation Center in Clarion. Arrangements are with the Ewing Funeral Home of Clarion. Next up, Donna M. Hill, age 81, of Clarion, died Saturday, September 24th at Iowa Specialty Hospital of Clarion. Arrangements are with the Ewing Funeral Home of Clarion. And then finally, Joseph Bernard Roddinghouse, age 86, died Tuesday, September 27th at Good Shepherd Health Care Center of Mason City. Arrangements are the Ward Van Slyke Colonial Chapel of Clear Lake. And with that being read and said, we're moving on to the world of sports now in the Mason City Globe Gazette. And we're talking prep cross country. And the photo at the top shows Lake Mills' Justin Rye makes the turn around one of the holes at Garner Golf and Country Club during Monday's Garner Invite for the running cross country. Rye won the boys' race in an unofficial time of just over 17 minutes. All right. Lake Mills becomes a threat in team races. And that photo at the top does show Justin Rye running. Looks like he's going at it pretty fast. The photo below shows Lake Mills freshman Newt Rogney approaching the turn around one of the holes at Garner Golf and Country Club during Monday's Garner Invite. The Bulldogs have no seniors in varsity lineup, pushed by legacy top runner. It's written by Zach Martin of the Globe Gazette. When Beth Van Rokel took the job as Lake Mills cross country coach, she knew she had two things on the boys' side: a surefire number one runner and potentially a number two runner. What she didn't have was depth. That part had to be acquired through recruiting at the high school and in the middle school ranks. We have a number one out there. That's a lot less people we have to score, Van Rokel said. We're working a little more on speed. We have a chance to be a competitive team. It has paid off. The Bulldogs not only have identified the front, but the other three in their scoring five have become more consistent in roles and has turned them into a unit to watch as October approaches. At Monday's Garner Invite, Lake Mills was second in the team race behind the host Cardinals with 63 points. After the first four meets of finishing with over 120 points, it has gone under 75 the last two, which has resulted in back-to-back runner-up finishes. The Bulldogs' top runner, Justin Rye, admitted team success was not a high point under the previous coaching staff. It has been a complete 180 under Van Rokel and her volunteer assistant. Lake Mills finished last amongst the qualifying teams at last year's Top of Iowa Conference meet. Over the last two meets, it has edged out Newman Catholic and Osage, two top five teams last season. Just putting the teams first, Rye said, the overall workouts improving and the attitudes of all of her athletes. Just having that to push them has helped our whole team, knocking down PRs and knocking down our next obstacle. Rye has eclipsed the levels of his older brother, Carson, time-wise. When he ran 16 minutes, 22 seconds last week at the Panthers Invite, held at Pioneer Town and Country Club, it was better than Carson's personal best. That course is a site for a Class 1A state qualifier, and Lake Mills could be a team in the field. It has been a big goal of mine to get up where he was during his high school years, Rye said. It feels like I am finally one of the Rye boys. After a 13th place showing at the conference meet at the Northern Iowa Area Community College as a sophomore, Rye couldn't maintain his momentum the following week at Newman in the state qualifier. The time was 4 seconds slower, and he was 16 seconds off from the 10th and final individual spot. His work ethic is just insane when it comes to running, Van Roeckel said. He put all that work in, and now look what is happening. He's in a good place. Orai spent his summer maintaining 40-mile weeks, increasing it a bit as the summer went along, then going back down when his schedule got hectic with responsibilities as a construction worker and helping out on the family farm. Even in the decline, he felt he was in prime shape for the fall. The summer workouts set up a good base, Rye said. I just did my best to keep logging miles. What helped Lake Mills is the move in of freshman Newt Rogney, the son of Lake Mills' new superintendent. He was a standout in middle school, and it has translated to high school. Rogney has been a consistent face in the top 10 for the Bulldogs. His best time with a handful of meets to go is 17 minutes, 37.55 seconds. That was a huge blessing, Van Roeckel said. He's matched by PR from last season, so he's shown a lot of really good improvement, Rye said. Well, the Bulldogs have filled out the rest of the lineup with underclassmen. They don't have a single senior in their varsity lineup. It has made their feeling of chasing a top five finish at the conference meet attainable. I love the team aspect, and it is pushing everybody, Van Roeckel said. A top three would be amazing. How we've improved and grown, and the new kids we've had come in. I wasn't expecting to be so competitive. We got to look at it one day at a time. Mason City girls win team title at Algona. Despite not having number two runner Jenna Hansen, the River Hawks were able to nab their most impressive team win yet at the Algona Invite that featured five ranked teams and the other three classifications on Monday. Behind Audra Mulholland, resetting the record books with a time of 19 minutes, 38 seconds to finish in second, Mason City clipped 3A number 8 Spencer and number 12 Clear Lake by 7 points to claim first place. Mulholland became the first Mason City girls runner to run under 20 minutes in 5,000 meters. Savannah Davis finished 12th to be its number two runner in 21 minutes and 19 seconds, while Elise Dykstra, Olivia Schissel, and Claudia Sewell all finished in the top 25. Clear Lake and Spencer each scored 80 points, but the Tigers earned the tiebreaker with their sixth runner finishing 16 seconds and 4 places ahead of the Lions' number six runner. Addison Dohan won the individual title in 19 minutes and 6 seconds, a new season best for the sophomore. Forest City was sixth in the team race with 174 points, fueled by Lily Nelson's 8th place finish in 20 minutes and 46 seconds. Charles City was 10th with 237 points. Its highest finisher was Harper McEnroy, placing 21st. On the boys' side, all four area teams finished in the top 10 in the team race. Clear Lake was 3rd with 122 points, Charles City 5th with 143, Forest City 7th with 161, and Mason City 9th with 197. The highest area finisher was Riverhawks senior Jess Cornick, placing 6th in 17 minutes and 26 seconds as their top runner without the services of Brant Hakenstad. Lions senior Jack Kane was 8th in 17 minutes and 36 seconds as the other top 10 runner in the area. Charles City had 2 in the top 15 and Nick Williams 11th and Xander Grazer 13th, separated by 7 seconds. Forest City's top runner was Parker Sharp, crossing the finish line in 24th place. Exciting stuff happening there in cross country. Moving on now to Iowa State football from page B1. Anderson compliments McDonald in pass rush. That's written by Rob Gray, special to the Globe Gazette, Dateline Ames, where Baylor quarterback Blake Shapen pranced out of the pocket under duress and out of options. Iowa State defensive end M.J. Anderson provided the hot pursuit, finally reaching Shapen, wrapping up his legs and recording an apparent sack. Then he saw the flag, but his heart didn't sink. He happily lined up to play on. It is what it is, I feel like, said Anderson, who saw his first career sack as a Cyclone swept away by one of several costly penalties last Saturday in a 31-24 setback. I'm just having fun, man. This is probably the best time in my life right about now. Anderson's ability to both rush the passer and wrap up running backs has been crucial, as ISU, with a 3-1 overall record and 0-1 in the Big 12, continues to find ways to thwart opposing offenses that double team all-time sacks leader Will McDonald and scheme to run plays to his opposite side. And the Minnesota transfer's efforts will need to ratchet up a notch this Saturday at the Cyclones to topple rejuvenated Kansas with a 4-0 overall record, 1-0 in their conference at 2:30 p.m. in Lawrence. You've got to play a football to win football games, said ISU head coach Matt Campbell, whose team owns a 7-game win streak against the Jayhawks. And maybe you can play B-plus football and still get beat right now, so credit to everybody in this conference, especially Kansas, which has given up just one sack through four games while rushing for an average of 245.3 yards per game. That's where Anderson comes in, along with McDonald and other teammates who will be deployed in blitz packages and or as spies to try to curtail the production of the Jayhawks quarterback Jalon Daniels, who's thrown for 11 touchdowns and rushed for a team high, tying four more. A really good offense, a really good team, said Cyclone safety Malik Verdon, who notched a career-high 6 tackles in the Baylor loss. Just need to be able to prepare right mentally, physically, play our defense, and do what we do. Well, Anderson's emergence as a disruptive bookend to McDonald on the edge has helped ISU continue to be very good at what it does. He's made 7 tackles this season and narrowly missed out on at least 2 sacks. The 6'3", 275-pound junior overcame elbow surgery in the spring and progressed steadily through summer workouts, setting the stage for early season production with more to possibly come. One of the things I've enjoyed about MJ is he loves football, Campbell said, and he really goes to work at it. Even through that journey of getting back healthy, it's been a real joy to watch his process. He's got a chance to be really special, and who he is on top of it has fit us greatly, Campbell went on to say. Anderson's approach to football and life mirrors Campbell's. Love the game, play hard, project greatness on and off the field. Those, of course, are universally prized attributes in all programs, but Campbell's emphasis on those bare-bones core principles enlivens Anderson as he seeks to make a broader impact every game, not just a play here or there. Well, I honestly feel like every Saturday you can just get an opportunity to get on that grass with the boys and just get dirty. You know what I'm saying, Anderson said. It's just fun. Well, in other sports news, we talk about Iowa State. We're going to talk about Iowa football now here on page B1. B1 with your radio now listening to Iris here. With Iowa football, Hawkeyes looking forward, not back. Fourth-ranked Michigan waltzes into Kinnick looking for a first win in 4 tries. As written by Steve Batterson of the Quad City Times, airing here in the Mason City Globe Gazette. Dateline Iowa City, that was then, this is now. While there were lessons learned in the 42-3 beating Michigan handed the Iowa football team in the 2022 Big Ten Championship game, the Hawkeyes are looking forward, not back this week. It's 2022, not 2021, just like 2019 was not 2016, Iowa quarterback Spencer Petras said Tuesday. It's a new year, and that's the way we're going at it. Some things haven't changed in the 9 months since the Hawkeyes were handed the second-worst loss during Coach Kirk Ferentz's tenure on the Iowa sidelines. They have a lot of really good players, and they've been very productive, very successful, Ferentz said. It's going to take our best team effort to have a chance in this ballgame. So it's a big challenge for us. Ferentz said this year's Michigan team seems to have picked up where last year's team left off, winning its first Big Ten football championship since sharing the title with Iowa in 2004. The fourth-ranked Wolverines, who haven't won at Kinnick Stadium in 4 visits since an overtime victory in 2005, arrive for Saturday's 11:05 a.m. game with a 4-0 record and an offense which is averaging a nation-leading 50 points per game. Wow. That, as much as anything that transpired in the past, has the Hawkeyes' attention as they prepare for their first Big Ten home game of the season. We can't do anything about what happened in the past, defensive back Kayvon Merriweather said. It's about getting ready for this Michigan team, which is another good one. Running back Blake Corum enters the game coming off a 243-yard rushing effort on 30 carries in the Wolverines' 34-27 victory over Maryland last weekend. Although last year's starting quarterback Cade McNamara returns, J.J. McCarthy has settled in under center and has completed 80% of his 60 pass attempts through three starts. Simply put, the Hawkeyes have plenty to prepare for this week. It's great to have a top-five team coming into Kinnick. We know the crowd will be into it. There will be a lot of energy, but we know that we have to be on top of our game, Merriweather said. Well, that didn't happen last December in Indianapolis, and if the Hawkeyes take anything from that game, Ferentz said understanding the importance of paying attention to the details should be at the top of the list. He suggested he'll leave the notion of viewing this as some sort of revenge game to the individuals, up to the individuals. Those words aren't coming out of my mouth, Ferentz said. Instead, he simply wants Iowa to be ready. If you aren't on top of things and you give up a couple of big plays, all of a sudden, the hill against these guys gets pretty steep, Ferentz added. When you're trying to ascend a hill like that against a team that's that talented, it's tough. It's tough, and then they've got you where they want you. Big plays made a difference early in the Big Ten title game, where Corum scored on a 67-yard run and Roman Wilson caught a 75-yard touchdown pass to leave the Hawkeyes in a 14-0 first quarter hole. That is why Ferentz said finding a way to keep the game close is where Iowa's work begins. You have to make sure that every play is sound, and if they're going to get something, make them really work and earn it, Ferentz said. We didn't necessarily do that last year. If somebody has motivation that comes out of that, I think we all want to do better, needless to say. But it's not as simple as, hey, let's go get these guys. I wish it was. While Michigan returns eight starters on offensive from last year's team and has just four returning defensive starters, Petras said, the Wolverines look a lot like last year's team. They have a new defensive coordinator and former Vanderbilt coordinator Jesse Minter, but a lot of what they do is the same, Petras said. They know what they want to be, and they know how to make it work. They'll have some new wrinkles, everybody does, but they are still who they are. Fullback Monte Potabom sees that as well. We know what they're capable of. We saw that last year, Potabom said. It wasn't a lot of fun getting beat by 39 points. That's not what Iowa football is about. It's up to us to be ready to go. Well, we're taking care of that. Why don't we go on to this day in history. On September 28th, Scottish medical researcher Alexander Fleming discovered penicillin, the first effective antibiotic. On September 28th, 1781, American forces in the Revolutionary War, backed by a French fleet, began their successful siege of Yorktown, Virginia, which brought that war to an end. On our side, thank God. In 1841, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow completed his poem Excelsior. In 1850, flogging was abolished as a form of punishment in the U.S. Navy. In 1920, eight members of the Chicago White Sox were indicted for allegedly throwing the 1919 World Series against the Cincinnati Reds. All were acquitted at trial, but all eight were banned for life. In 1924, three U.S. Army planes landed in Seattle, having completed the first round-the-world trip by air in 175 days. In 1939, during World War II, Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union signed a treaty calling for the partitioning of Poland, which the two countries had invaded. In 1958, voters in the African country of Guinea overwhelmingly favored independence from France. In 1962, a federal appeals court found Mississippi Governor Ross Barnett in civil contempt for blocking the admission of James Meredith, a black student, to the University of Mississippi. Federal marshals escorted Meredith onto the campus 2 days later. In 1995, Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat signed an accord at the White House ending Israel's military occupation of West Bank cities and laying the foundation for a Palestinian state. In the year 2000, capping a 12-year battle, the government approved use of the abortion pill RU486. In 2019, voters in Afghanistan went to the polls to elect a president for the fourth time since a U.S.-led coalition ousted the Taliban regime in 2001. The vote was marred by violence, Taliban threats, and widespread allegations of mismanagement. After a series of delays, the country's Independent Election Commission announced months later that Ashraf Ghani had won a second term as president. In 2020, the worldwide death toll from coronavirus pandemic topped 1 million, according to the count by Johns Hopkins University. And then 10 years ago, citing national security risks, President Barack Obama blocked a Chinese company from owning four wind farm projects in northern Oregon near a Navy base where the U.S. military flew unmanned drones and electronic warfare planes on training missions. Those notes from the AP. Moving on now with more briefs, which we covered earlier. Move on to, we're on page A4 again, continuing with the Iran protests, where hardline Iranian lawmaker Mahmoud Nabavian on Tuesday slammed female protesters who have taken off mandatory headscarves as prostitutes amid deadly demonstrations following the death of a woman detained by the country's morality police. January 6th probe, the House committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol announced Tuesday that it will postpone a hearing scheduled for Wednesday as the hurricane headed toward Florida. Targeting propaganda, a disinformation network originating in Russia sought to use hundreds of fake social media accounts and dozens of sham news websites to spread Kremlin talking points about Ukraine, Facebook and Instagram parent Meta said Tuesday. Kickbacks scheme. Massachusetts pharmaceutical company Biogen agreed to pay $900 million to resolve allegations that it violated federal law by paying kickbacks to doctors to persuade them to prescribe its multiple sclerosis drugs, federal prosecutors said. And finally, Kamala Harris. In meetings with Asian leaders Tuesday, Kamala Harris emphasized the U.S. commitment to regional security. She is scheduled to visit the demilitarized zone dividing the rival Koreas on Thursday. She has been in Tokyo to attend the funeral of assassinated former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. And we'll talk about hurricanes and probably our last or at least second to last story here on page A4 for this reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette. Hurricane heads toward Florida. U.S. braces as Ian hits Cuba, leaving 1 million people without electricity. This written by Christiana Mesquita and Kurt Anderson of the AP, Dateline Havana. Hurricane Ian tore into western Cuba as a major hurricane Tuesday and left 1 million people without electricity, then churned on a collision course with Florida over warm Gulf waters amid expectations it would strengthen into a catastrophic Category 4 storm. Ian made landfall in Cuba's Pinar del Rio province, where officials set up 55 shelters, evacuated 50,000 people, rushed in emergency personnel, and took steps to protect crops in the nation's main tobacco-growing region. The U.S. National Hurricane Center said Cuba suffered significant wind and storm surge impacts when the hurricane struck with top sustained winds of 125 miles per hour. Ian was expected to get even stronger over the warm Gulf of Mexico, reaching top winds of 130 miles per hour as it approaches the southwest coast of Florida, where 2.5 million people were ordered to evacuate. Tropical storm force winds were expected across the southern peninsula late Tuesday, reaching hurricane force Wednesday, when the hurricane's eye was predicted to make landfall. With tropical storm force winds extending 140 miles from Ian's center, damage was expected across a wide area of Florida. It was not yet clear precisely where Ian would come ashore. Its exact track could determine how severe the storm surge is for Tampa Bay, said University of Miami hurricane researcher Brian McNulty. Landfall south of the bay could make the impact much less bad, McNulty said. Hundreds of residents were being evacuated from several nursing homes in the Tampa area, where hospitals were also moving some patients. Airports in Tampa, St. Petersburg, and Key West closed. Busch Gardens in Tampa closed ahead of the storm, while several Orlando-area theme parks, including Disney World and SeaWorld, planned to close Wednesday and Thursday. NASA rolled its moon rocket from the launch pad to its Kennedy Space Center hangar, adding weeks of delay to the test flight. Okay, with the time we have left, we can do one more short story. Yellen issues dire climate warning, as it's headlined. Treasury Secretary says inaction could lead to an economic crisis, written by Hannah Schoenbaum of the AP and Report for America, Dateline Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned Tuesday of economic calamity if climate change is not addressed with immediate government intervention. Joined by local business owners and prominent Democrats in North Carolina, Yellen said the increasing frequency and severity of natural disasters could create devastating short-term supply reductions of everyday goods that could cause prices to skyrocket. Supply chain disruptions like those experienced on a global scale during the COVID-19 pandemic could soon become commonplace, she said during a visit to Cypress Creek Renewables Solar Farm in Chapel Hill. As North Carolina is gearing up for several tight races in November, Yellen pitched the benefit of Democrats' new climate, health, and tax law, the Inflation Reduction Act, that will spend $375 billion over the next decade on climate-related investments. Combined with last year's bipartisan infrastructure law, the investments total more than $430 billion. The money will be spent on everything from providing tax credits to purchasers of qualifying electric vehicles to building clean manufacturing facilities. Yellen said spending will be particularly impactful in non-coastal communities that have suffered from disinvestment. All right, all those things. In the Mason City Globe Gazette, that is the September 28th edition. It's brought to you here on the morning of September 29th. Hope you're having a good start to your day. Don't forget the Des Moines Register is next, the live reading of that. And this is your reader. My name is Andrew Halp, filling in into the microphone. Thank you so much for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. We hope you have a good day, good rest of your day, good week. Thank you so much for listening. Keep it real and straight ahead.